Hi, and welcome to the Magazine Rack on Chris. I'm Laura Bogart. Today, I'll be reading from the Smithsonian Magazine, and the first article, taken out of the prologue section, is written by Natalie Escobar, titled Girl Power, How A Wrinkle in Time Liberated Young Adult Literature. When Lena Roy was 7 years old, her teacher read the first chapter of A Wrinkle in Time aloud to her second grade class. After school, Lena ran to her grandmother's house, which was around the corner from her school on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, to finish the book on her own. She curled up in bed and devoured it. She felt just like the hothead, stubborn heroine Meg Murray, and took comfort in the fact that a flawed adolescent girl could save the world. It was almost like your permission to be a real person, Roy says. You don't have to be perfect. Millions of other adolescent girls and boys have made the same liberating discovery while reading A Wrinkle in Time. What's different about Roy is that her grandmother happened to be Madeline L'Engle, the book's author, who revolutionized serious young adult fiction with her clever mashup of big ideas, science fantasy and adventure, and a geeky girl action hero way ahead of her time. Since its 1962 publication, Wrinkle has sold more than 10 million copies and been turned into a graphic novel, an opera, and two films, including an ambitious adaptation from the director Ava DuVernay, due out in March. The book also kicked open the door for other bright young heroines and the amazing, lucrative franchises they appear in. From whip-smart Hermione Granger in the Harry Potter books to the lethal Katniss Everdeen in The Hunger Games. Leonard Marcus, author of the L'Engle biography Listening for Madeline, says Wrinkle set the stage for the reception of Harry Potter in this country. Previously, he says, science fiction and fantasy were suitable for high-end British authors like C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien in Britain. But in the States, we were relegated to pulp magazines and drugstore paperbacks. Then came L'Engle, a 41-year-old writer who spent 3 months in 1959 writing the hard-to-categorize story that would become A Wrinkle in Time. While Meg Murray and her companions traveled through time and space to save her father, a scientist trapped by evil forces on a distant planet, readers had to wrap their minds around the fifth dimension, the horrors of conformity, and the power of love. L'Engle believed that literature should show youngsters they were capable of taking on the forces of evil in the universe, not just the everyday pains of growing up. If it's not good enough for adults, she once wrote, it's not good enough for children. Publishers hated it. Every firm her agent turned to rejected the manuscript. One advertised to do a cutting job on it by half. Another complained, it's something between an adult and juvenile novel. Finally, a friend advised L'Engle to send the manuscript to one of the most prestigious houses of all, Farr, Straus, and Giraud. John Farr liked the manuscript. A test reader he gave it to, though, was unimpressed. I think this is the worst book I have ever read. It reminds me of The Wizard of Oz. Yet FSG acquired it, and Hal Vercel, the book's editor, talked it up in letters he sent to reviewers. It's distinctly odd, extremely well written, he wrote to one, and is going to make greater intellectual and emotional demands on 12 to 16-year-olds than most formula fictions for this age group. When it debuted, not only was Wrinkle widely praised, wholly absorbing, said the New York Times Book Review, but it won the Newbery Medal, the most important award in children's literature. The almost universal reaction of children to this year's winning book by wanting to talk about it to each other and to elders shows the deep desire to understand as well as to enjoy, said Newbery committee member Ruth Gallardo. American publishers, initially resistant to genre bending, soon were producing their own teen epics, including Lloyd Anderson's Newbery-winning Chronicles of Pride in Books and Ursula Le Guin Earthsea series. L'Engle went on to write more than 40 books, including works of nonfiction and poetry, though none was as acclaimed as Wrinkle. None was as controversial either. Libraries and schools frequently banned the novels because of its entanglements with religion. In one passage, Jesus Christ is compared to Shakespeare. Einstein, and the Buddha. On the American Library Association's list of most frequently challenged for the 1990s, Wrinkle was number 23. Among the countless girls changed forever by Lengel's book was Diane Duane, who first read it as a 10-year-old in 1962. She'd consumed all the science fiction and fantasy at her local library, but had never encountered anyone like Meg. Finally, Duane recalls, here was a girl character being treated as if her take on what was going on around her, her analysis and her emotional reactions to the things that were happening around her, were real and were worth paying attention to. Today, Duane is hailed as the best-selling author of So You Want to Be a Wizard and other titles in her Young Wizards fantasy series, which features a young female protagonist, Nita. All the time, Lengel's shadow, and a very bright shadow, it has to be said, was laying over that work for me, Duane says. It would have been very difficult for me to do that writing without thinking about her a lot. Lena Roy, who is a writing teacher in New York and the co-author of the upcoming biography of her grandmother, Becoming Madeline, doesn't remember Lengel ever calling herself a feminist, though she was proud of being what Roy calls a trailblazing woman. Lengel had spent her years at Smith College editing the campus literary magazine alongside Betty Friedan, who later penned The Feminine Mystique. Lengel herself suggested it was easy to make her protagonist a strong girl. "I'm a female," she once said. "Why would I give all the best ideas to a male?" Now the movie adaptation of Wrinkle is poised to make Lengel's creation even more groundbreaking. DuVernay, the first woman of color to direct a live-action film with a production budget over $100 million, intentionally cast non-white actors in lead roles. Storm Reid will play Meg, and Derek McCabe will play her younger brother, Charles. In 1962, it was radical to see a young girl in charge. Now, a new generation of black girls and boys can see themselves on screen and dream of saving the world. The next article, also out of the prologue section, is titled Hot Ticket, written by Annette Gordon-Reed. It promised to be a spectacle in a period that had seen its share of them. 3 years after the end of a bloody civil war that had sundered the Union, and nearly 3 years after the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, the government of the United States had triggered the most serious process in the constitutional mechanism, the power of impeachment. On February 24, 1868, the House of Representatives voted along party lines, 126-47, to impeach President Andrew Johnson for having committed high crimes and misdemeanors. Days later, a House committee drew up 9 articles of impeachment against the 17th president. They would later add 2 more. The vast majority of the articles were related to the main charge against Johnson, that he had violated the Tenure of Office Act, which prohibited the president from removing, without Senate approval, any official who had been appointed to the office, with the advice and consent of the Senate. Congress had enacted the law to check Johnson's behavior. The Tennessean, who had remained loyal to the Union, called Southerners who rebelled traitors, and said forcefully that treason must be punished, changed his harsh tune once he became president after Lincoln's death. He embarked upon a program of conciliation toward the White South, emboldening the former Confederates in ways that angered members of Congress and many Northerners as well. His decision to fire the Secretary of War, Edwin M. Stanton, with whom he had political disagreements, was simply the last of what Congress considered to be Johnson's long train of abuses. After the House vote, the action moved to the Senate to fulfill its duty to conduct a trial and determine whether Johnson would remain in office. Trials have always been a spectacle sport. For centuries, the public has followed them in newspapers and by attending the proceedings. The trial of Andrew Johnson was no different. It began on March 5, 1868, and the country was riveted. The newspapers, according to historian Hans Trefusi, reported every incident with relish, and huge crowds sought admission to the Senate. Access to the Senate trial was limited to ticket holders, and a fortunate few members of the public crowded into the gallery to hear the senators make their cases. An actual ticket is in the collections of the Smithsonian National Museum of American History. Some legislators had developed reputations as great performers in the courtroom setting and could be counted on to entertain the rapt audience. Obviously, this was much more than an entertaining trial. The confrontation between Johnson and the men who wanted to remove him from office, the so-called Radical Republicans, was a fight over the future direction of the United States, a fight with implications that reverberate to this day. Johnson's real crime in the eyes of opponents, that was he had used the power of the presidency to prevent Congress from giving aid to the 4 million African Americans freed after the Civil War. Johnson's deep antipathy toward black people, not his view of the Constitution, guided his actions. What did it mean for the country's future that the man at the head of the government, at a moment when black people's fortunes were being decided, hated blacks? Johnson had opposed slavery because he thought it hurt the class of poor whites from which it had come. Blacks were to be freed, but left to the mercy of white Southerners. His plan of action, to put whites back in charge in the South, set him on a collision course with the Radical Republicans who believed that the South must be transformed to incorporate blacks into American society as equals. Johnson opposed congressional measures adopted to try to help African Americans become productive members of society with the dignity accorded to whites. He opposed black suffrage, land reform, and efforts to protect blacks against the violence that Southern whites unleashed upon them after the war's end. Because he had no vice president, if Johnson had been removed from office, he was impeached but not convicted and removed from office. Benjamin Wade, the president's pro tempore, would have taken his place. A President Wade, radical Republican and champion of black rights, might have altered the course of American history, perhaps for the better. And now an article written by Wen Quy Duc, titled In Search of Vietnam, The Battles of 1968 Are Long Over, But the Struggle to Confront the Truth Goes On. A few years ago, a French-German TV crew visited my home in Hanoi for an interview on how Vietnam has changed since the end of the war with America. We talked of post-war problems, the people's achievements, the old and new generations of leaders, and the country's aspirations. We also talked of history, of course. At one point, our conversation veered toward the events surrounding the Tet Offensive in January 1968. It took but a few seconds for the government media minder, an official from the foreign ministry, to stop us. Agitated, she told me to stay inside while she took the producer and reporter out to my garden, where she threatened to shut down the production if the subject was broached again, or even if we returned to the general topic of 1968. Later, I told her about all the information on the war that was freely available. Books, documentary films, television shows, photographs, articles, and essays. I showed her Google listings. I tried to point out that the more she tried to suppress the information, the more that journalist would dig deeper. I could barely hide my anger. "You will not talk about that," she kept saying. "You will not." 50 years after the fact, the Tet Offensive is recognized as the pivotal event in the pivotal year of the war, a military loss for North Vietnam, but a political victory, as the shock of the attack began to turn American public opinion against the conflict. Breaking a truce that was supposed to allow the warring sides to celebrate Tet, or the Lunar New Year, communist leaders sent tens of thousands of soldiers and Viet Cong guerrillas into the cities and military bases all over South Vietnam, including Saigon, home of the U.S. Embassy. They believed they could take the Army of the Republic of Vietnam and its U.S. allies by surprise and inspire a general uprising that would overthrow the government of the South. They succeeded in the first mission, but failed in the second. They sustained heart-stopping losses. The U.S. reported 40,000 enemy casualties and quickly ceded whatever ground they'd taken. But not in Hue, the former imperial capital in central Vietnam. The battle for Hue went on for 26 days and proved to be one of the bloodiest of the war. the dead among Northern forces numbered 5,000 or more. The Americans and South Vietnamese suffered more than 600 dead and almost 3,200 wounded. In Vietnam today, this event is described in heroic terms, and the state propaganda machine still goes into overdrive to celebrate it every few years. But of the massacre of thousands of Hue civilians? Not a word. Shortly after the communists were driven out, people in Hue began to discover mass graves. South Vietnamese government television channels showed horrifying scenes of grieving families and unidentified corpses that had been hastily buried. Some were presumed to be the intellectuals and teachers, government cadres, civil servants, and administrators who had gone missing during the communist occupation. Physical evidence showed that many of them had been tied, blindfolded, and shot point blank, or buried alive. No one knows exactly how many people were killed. Several accounts put it at more than 3,000, most of them civilians. They died in a deliberate campaign by the communist forces to destroy Hue's government. This massacre is deeply embedded in Western accounts of the battle for the Hue, but little discussed in Vietnam. And yet, in what was, for the Vietnamese people, a civil war, the fratricidal nature of this event could not have been more stark. This is what I had begun to tell the journalist about when the government minder cut us off. In January 1968, my family was living in Da Nang, but to celebrate Tet, we made the hour's drive to my paternal grandparents' house in Hue. My father was the region's civil governor, and whenever we went to Hue, we stayed in a gorgeous government guest house. A mansion, really, immaculately kept with Art Deco arches and curves. I loved running back and forth in the corridors, on the terrace, or in the many gardens. On the first night of the Lunar New Year, January 30th, we heard what we thought were firecrackers. The sound was actually gunfire. Bullets were flying in every direction. Flares occasionally lit the sky, but the grounds around our house were dark. We had no way of seeing that communist troops had surrounded us. At 2 o'clock in the morning of January 31st, they came into the house and took my father upstairs, along with other men they rounded up in the neighborhood. They herded about 100 of us, mostly women and children, into a neighboring basement. In the dark, my mother tried to keep me and my two sisters very quiet. We were dazed and afraid. A communist soldier gave a lecture about coming as our liberators, securing our city, and driving out imperialist invading forces. I was 9 years old. I could barely understand anything he said in his northern accent, but he seemed menacing. Until that night, the war had been something that happened in the forest and mountains or villages far away. It was 2 days before we were allowed to go back into the guest house. Mattresses and clothes littered the rooms, and the furniture had been thrown all over. Upstairs, my father was sitting on the floor with a number of other men. We huddled next to him, but we were afraid, so afraid we were unable to speak. After just a few minutes, soldiers told us to leave. On the way out, we stole a look into my parents' room. My father's treasured books were on the floor, and the suitcases had been rifled through. Someone had cut a hole through my mother's traveling jewelry box. We left empty-handed and returned to our basement prison with no idea of what was in store. 2 nights later, my mother motioned me to a tiny window in the basement. I climbed on the bed and strained to look out. The soldiers had lined up a row of men and tied their elbows behind their backs. After a while, they marched the men away. I saw my father among them. A week later, the communist soldiers withdrew from the government house. South Vietnamese and American troops freed us and moved us to Hue University by the bank of the Perfume River. The campus had been turned into a refugee center and makeshift hospital. From the sixth floor, I could see the fighting across the river. I also saw people with horrendous wounds being brought in. Most days, we sat dazed on a straw mat while the adults gathered in corners for whispered conversations. After weeks of house-to-house fighting, the soldiers recaptured the citadel, the heart of the old imperial city, on February 24th. When we managed to get back to Da Nang, our house was full of relatives who had also fled from Hue. We had no news about my father and no way of finding any. For the first year, we did not tell my grandfather that my father had been taken. We were afraid he would die of a heart attack. My mother went to the neighbors' houses to cry so he wouldn't find out. Months later, news came about the mass graves. My mother went to Hugh to look for my father, but the sight of the decaying and maimed corpses horrified her. She never went back. I grew up not quite an orphan. While other families buried their dead, set up an altar, and had some kind of closure, ours had this open secret. Schoolmates didn't quite know what to do with me, and for years I was ostracized. I grew into a morose adolescent, but I found consolation in the anti-war songs of Trin Con Sun, who laminated the bodies, floating in the river, drying out in rice fields, lying on city roofs, under the temple eaves, under cold, rainy nights, bodies of the aged next to the innocent. Although the government banned his music, it seemed that all of South Vietnam listened to it. In the months and then the years following the Tet Offensive, we were terrorized by the thought that a communist victory anywhere in the South would mean more massacres, more people buried alive. It would be even worse than Tet 68. That fear shaped my fate. As communist forces closed in on Saigon in 1975, my uncles arranged for me to go to the United States. Like my sister De Ha before me, I became one of millions of Viet Q, overseas Vietnamese. But my mother remained in Vietnam, stuck in the chaos that followed the communist victory that April. While I spent my adolescence coming to grips with America's abundance and frenetic energy, she was stripped of her job as the principal of a school and reduced to poverty. After moving into her sister's house in what had been renamed Ho Chi Minh City, she sometimes sold soup on the streets to support herself and my other sister, who proved to be mentally ill and would die too young. In 1973, the leaders of the North and South signed the agreement that led the Americans' exit from the war and began a prisoner exchange. One of those exchanged prisoners managed to smuggle out a letter to my mother. "I am lucky to be alive," my father wrote. It was the first time in 5 years we had had any word either from or about him. "I hope that you are able to take care of the children, a task that I am anxious to share with you." It took 4 more years of searching for my mother to find out that he was being held in a remote area near the Chinese border. She set out to visit him and discovered that he had been reduced to a thin old man, but his spirits seemed high. He was released in 1980 after 12 years captivity without a trial. 4 years later, the communist government allowed him and my mother to immigrate to the United States. I hadn't seen him for 16 years, during which I had come of age, gotten a fitful education, and set out on a haphazard path that would lead me to a career as a radio journalist. When I met my parents at the airport in San Francisco, he was astonishingly healthy and sane. She was less sure of herself than I had remembered. We spent many months rediscovering each other, but we moved backward in time, taking the most recent years first. We never talked of 1968. It was too overwhelming. He wrote about his prison years and published a book of poems he had composed in captivity and kept in his memory until he left the country. He used one phrase as a preface: "I suffer, therefore I am." He read the books and saw the documentaries about the Tet Offensive, but he said no more about it until he died in 2000. Despite all that history, I began to consider moving back to Vietnam. It was still my country, after all, and Vietnamese traditionally have a strong sense of place. I finally moved back in 2006 to the city where my father's captors had directed the war. I've made many new friends in Hanoi, young and old, but their curiosity about a Viet Q who came back from the United States has not extended to the details of my experience of the war. Some of them have lived and heard enough of it, and many had an equally traumatic time of it. Plus, Vietnam is a youthful country. The median age is 30 years. The majority of the people were born after the war and long after 1968, so they are forward-looking. Integrating with the globalized world is a national mantra. In nightclubs and cafes, the music of Trinh Con Son is still popular. The love songs, not the ones about the destruction of war. Those are once again banned. My friend Tran Anh Quan, an artist in his 40s who is rather critical of the government, often tells me I'm obsessed with the past. "You don't know what else the authorities hide," Quan tells me. "We don't even know the truth about what's happening in our society today. Forget about the past." Occasionally, I can. Then comes a moment like the time a real estate developer approached me with his business plan for Hue. "I want to redevelop the whole attitude there and change the tourist industry," he told me. Hue certainly attracts a lot of tourists. Many come for a past far removed. They visit ancient royal tombs, the refurbished citadel, and the temples from the Wen Dynasty, which lasted from 1802 to 1945. The tour guides tell all about that past, but they ignore the bullet holes pocketing the walls of the buildings within the citadel and elsewhere. No tourists are taken to the massacre grave sites the way tourists are taken to the infamous killing fields in Cambodia. I asked the developer about the ghosts in Hue, about the feelings among the people there who are living with the memories of the dead from 1968, about their feelings toward northerners like him. He had no idea what I was talking about. After 50 years, I know my memories from that era will last my lifetime. But I wonder whether the national silence about 1968 will ever be lifted, and the anger I felt when I was negotiating with the government's media minder still burns. Ultimately, she relented and allowed me to resume my conversation with the French-German team on camera. But I can find no record of that interview ever being aired in Vietnam. Recently, an acquaintance of mine, the writer Bao Nin, famed for his novel The Sorrow of War, pointed a finger at me and said, "You will write about it. You and me. We survived that Tet." Sure, it was the American War as Vietnamese remember it, and the Cold War was a big part of it. But the Tet Offensive and 1968 was us. We, Vietnamese, killed one another. So now I think of the media minder, "You will not." And I think of Bao Ning, "You will." One wanted me to honor a version of history written by the living, the winners. The other wishes me to honor the dead and their memories. 1968. A war, a year, a memory forever being buried and resurrected. That's it for this installment of the Magazine Rack. I've been reading from the January-February edition of the Smithsonian. I'm Laura Bogart. So long until next time.